This is once again Soundings taking over for Earth Mysteries. And once again, I've got Richard Hurley here with me in the studio. We're on the air last Monday talking about his book, California and the Civil War. Well, we were going to talk about California and the Civil War. We spent the entire program talking about leading up to the Civil War. And I believe we got to the first shot, perhaps, of the Civil War.
One California senator has died so far, and that was Broderick, who was killed in a duel, shot by our Supreme Court Chief Justice, who was pro-Southern.
Well, Richard, thank you for coming in again, and got some great response. Last week's program is on the KVMR webpage. You can download the podcast. I recommend you do. A real fast wrap-up. 1848, gold is discovered. 1849 brings in the 49ers. We had, what was it, a quarter million people?
In three years.
So,
and the great surprise of the existing population.
Which had been a very large existing population. And
150,000 Indians and fewer than 10,000 people of European descent.
And that 150,000 was down from 300,000,
right?
Because the Spanish had brought in all these diseases
that
killed the Indians ahead of them before they even...
Right. The Indian population is reeling from a biological attack, basically. But in the northern third of the state, you are still very much in charge of your own destiny if you are a member of an Indian tribe. And basically, things haven't changed except that you've had some horrific diseases sweep through.
So then we get this tremendous population surge, 1850, the Compromise of 1850, in which California enters the Union as a free state. Well, how free is a free state?
Not so much in the case of California. People who think of California as being free in the equivalent of a northern state would be surprised to learn that we have full-fledged legal Indian slavery here. And we also have Southerners attempting to bring in slaves and set up slave-powered mining companies. What there was at the time really was a legal limbo. California's constitution prohibited slavery, except for Indian slavery, but the U.S. government's policy and federal law made it very difficult to tell whether California's position was legal. A Southerner could come out, bring his slaves with him, and set up in shop and see what happened. And what usually happened is the local miners' councils got together and said, no, you can't do that. We don't particularly care about slavery one way or the other, but you can't have slave-powered mining companies. They were very jealous about the ethos of one man, one claim.
California enters as a free state, and at the same time, demographically, as far as the population here, it was very much a border state.
Absolutely. The Southerners who want to come out and mine gold come over, many of them come over the Butterfield stage line, which takes you across the Southwest and deposits you in Los Angeles. So Los Angeles, at the outset of the war, is a solidly secessionist polity. In fact, there's a town near there called Monty where it was really literally worth your life to declare support for Abraham Lincoln. Also, a lot of people came around the Horn or came via Panama, and they tended to cluster together with Americans from the same region of the states as themselves. So Southerners particularly would end up in the southern mines of California. So Sonora, for instance, is ardently secessionist. Stockton is mixed. So the southern mines, when the election comes, 1860 election, the areas that are serviced by the port of Stockton, the gold mining areas, end up giving the southern candidate a landslide.
So we have the election of 1860. Mm-hmm. Lincoln's name does not show up on the ballot in the southern states. Mm-hmm. We have so he was a Republican. We have the Democrats, but there are essentially two Democratic candidates.
The Democrats split in two, and their northern faction rallies behind Stephen Douglas, who is Lincoln's old adversary from the Illinois senator campaign of a few years before. And their policy is to let settlers in the new territories determine for themselves whether they want to have slavery. Douglas comes up with this policy as a desperate attempt to try to keep the Democratic Party together He's trying to placate the Southerners, but the Southerners are not placated, and they walk out of the Democratic convention, which is moving to nominate Douglas but can't come up with the requisite number of votes. And with them walk out the California delegates, the California Democrats. And they proceed to elect their own candidate, a gentleman by the name of Breckinridge, who is a full-blown supporter of slavery, states' rights, severe fugitive slave laws. And he takes most of the Southern electoral votes in 1860. Breckinridge does. He later becomes a Confederate general.
So the election of Lincoln precipitates, I'm sure there's a lot of other things that help precipitate this, yeah. But we come to the winter of 1860-1861, the Great Crisis.
Right. Yeah. That's where the Southern states look around and they decide finally whether they're going to act on the rhetoric that has been floating around Washington for a long time. South Carolina in particular leads the charge. People have to remember that slavery is enormously profitable, and Charleston, South Carolina was for many years the richest city in the United States. They had a particular kind of long grain cotton that worked very well in the international market. So they were very much attached to slavery, and they decided that Lincoln was a signal that the U.S. government was slipping out of their hands. They couldn't count on the U.S. to protect their investment in slavery, even though Lincoln was adamant that he was not going to interfere with slavery where it already existed. The Constitution expressly forbade him from doing so, and he was an adherent to the letter of the Constitution. But he did, and the Republicans at large, did want to restrict slavery from the Western territories, and the Southern leadership in 1860 saw his victory. And they said, this is it. We're out of here. And so the South, well, in particular, South Carolina goes in December. And over the next few months, the rest of the Deep South follows.
So we are used to looking at a map of North America, and there are essentially three countries. There's Canada, the U.S., and Mexico.
Right.
Had the South succeeded, there would have been literally four countries in North America.
At a minimum. Because once you have established that secession is legal, then any American state that has a serious grievance with national policy then has the option of withdrawing from the Union. So, for instance, in California, there was a pretty powerful movement before the Civil War to create something called the Republic of the Pacific. Washington was terribly remote. You know, it took weeks and weeks to get any kind of word out here, much less any federal money. And Californians felt neglected. And so there was a serious proposal as the nation became more and more fractured in the late 1850s to have California go off on its own, hopefully with Oregon. And that was labeled the Republic of the Pacific. People later, looking back at it, thought that maybe it was an effort to position California where it could effectively sit out the conflict and then later ally with the South if it looked like the South was going to win. But we're into speculation there. I mean, there's definitely movement to pull California out, but what that fraction, that fragment would have done is speculative.
In the Republic of the Pacific, it was, besides the gold, mm-hmm. what made California so important to either the Union or to the Southern Confederacy, which also had its eyes in California, was its location on the Pacific.
Right, and there just isn't a port like San Francisco anywhere else in the western portion of North America. It was a strategic asset of the First Order.
So war breaks out.
Right.
Where do we go from here? No, actually, let me back up on that. Not so much mm-hmm. where we go, but previously, the previous large war, series of wars, were the Napoleonic Wars, mm-hmm. Europe, early 1800s. How did the tactics and the weaponry of the Napoleonic Wars affect how the military leaders, both North and South, fought at least the first years of the Civil War?
The effect was catastrophic from the standpoint of the workaday soldier. A smoothbore musket, which is the kind that was wielded in the Napoleonic Wars, dictates tactics. where you mass large numbers of men, you march them up as close as possible to the enemy, and you fire. Because at any distance more than 80 yards, you're pretty much firing off into space. It's just inherent in the smoothbore musket that you are wildly inaccurate at any greater distance than that. And so all of the commanders, the American commanders, a large number of them have gone through this new institution of West Point, and they have read the works of the Napoleonic commanders, some of which were translated into English by a young man called Henry Halleck, who later becomes the Union commander-in-chief. And they all learn these tactics, and when you implement them on a battlefield where the men are carrying rifled muskets, which can kill you at 500 yards rather than 80.
Okay, we should back up here. See, they have a smoothbore. Not, and rifling means you put a groove, a spiral groove into the barrel.
Right.
And that forces the bullet to spiral as it comes out of the barrel.
Right.
If you don't have that, if you've got a smoothbore, that bullet is essentially tumbling.
Well, it spirals based on where it last touches the barrel.
So at random.
Yeah, it's a random spiraling, and it is at right angles to the path you want the bullet to follow. So in baseball terms, you're throwing a curveball, a random curveball, you know, that may end up 6 feet over the batter's head. And that's a terrible disadvantage. I mean, in Napoleonic warfare, you didn't shoot at an individual opponent. You shot at the mass of men. You and the rest of your company all fired a volley, and you know, they would fire back at you. And if you're in the Civil War battlefield and you're behind a stone wall like the Confederates were, say, at Fredericksburg, and you've got these poor Union troops marching towards you, one brigade after another, you're mowing them down before they ever get anywhere close to your position.
Because now instead of having a range of, what was it, 80 yards for the smoothbore?
Yeah.
Was it now about 500 yards?
500 yards, and you can put volley after volley into them. So basically it massively favors the defense if you are fighting the kind of war that was envisioned by the people of Napoleon's time.
How long did it take for the leaders, the generals, to realize this was not working and they had to change their tactics?
The smart ones figured it out pretty quick. And it changed it, but it takes a while to work out the implications of this. So the real telltale sign that the lesson has been assimilated is the siege of Petersburg at the end of the war, which is conducted around a massive series of trenches and abattis. They're systems for stopping troops from marching. Everybody's underground. And it really strongly prefigures World War One. If you look at a picture of the sieges, the trenches around Petersburg, and nobody's labeled the picture for you, you might easily think that you're looking at Flanders in 1917.
Thomas Starr King. There's a mountain in the Sierras, Mount Starr King. And I just learned there's also Mount Starr King in New Hampshire. Hmm. Before we actually get into the war, where was he in this?
He is the lucky card the Union drew in California. Okay, so he arrives out here in 1860. He's a practiced public speaker, an extraordinarily gifted man. His formal education ends at age 15, but he's mastered six or seven languages on his own while working as a clerk in the Charlestown Navy Yard, supporting his family. And he becomes a Unitarian minister in Boston. And to support his family, he works the Lyceum Lecture Circuit, which is a series of lectures which brought college-level, university-level ideas to the public at large in America, where very few people could afford higher education. So Starr King practices public speaking and is really a master of it when he comes to California in 1860. And it's just at that moment that California is thrashing. We are being run by the chivalry. The government is in Southern Democratic hands.
The chivalry being another name for the Southerners.
Southern Democrats, who are in the ascendant in California throughout the whole 1850s. Our government really is aligned with the South very strongly. But as a result of that duel we discussed last week, where the Southern Democratic Chief Justice shot and killed the Northern Democratic Senator, the Democratic Party has really started to unravel. So there's great uncertainty. Our governor at that time is a guy called John Downey. He's elected by the chivalry. He's a protege of the chivalry. And everybody's thinking, okay, well, you know, here's another guy. Now, he happens to be Irish. He doesn't own any slaves. He's never, you know, been, never spent much time in the South. And so he's an unknown quantity. The Republican Party is in disarray. Leland Stanford is a terrible public speaker. The fellow who would have led the party here, Edward Baker, a very close friend of Abraham Lincoln, has gone off to Oregon to become Oregon senator. And so there's a vacuum. And yet the unionist potential in California is clearly there. And you've got, just demographically, you've got a lot of people from New England out here. And you, if you look at the 1860 elections, you can say that it's basically one-third Southern, one-third committed Northern, and one-third probably Unionist, but not necessarily. And so Starr King gets out here, the man with the golden voice. And it was a good thing he had the golden voice because you could hardly see him. You know, he was tiny. He was 5'2". He weighed 120 pounds. He was actually of a very sickly constitution, but when he started speaking, he had this golden bass voice that would just roll out over the crowds, and he was a very engaging man. He had a great sense of humor. He could disarm his opponents, basically. He had a real magnetism that is the one feature that people who write about him, who knew him, talk about, and to the point where one fellow who knew him speculated that the whole rebellion could have been avoided if they just sent Starr King to the South and had him shake hands with the various plantation owners. So he is a thunderclap on the California scene. There's, in fact, the cover of my book is a picture of Starr King addressing 25,000 people on Market Street in 1861. He's just that much fun to listen to that even the Southerners show up to talk to him.
So I'll point out that the book that you just referred to is California and the Civil War. My guest today is Richard Hurley, the author of that book. This is a special edition of Soundings filling in for Earth Mysteries today, in case you're wondering. I'm Al Stoller. And as the war has broken out, people in California are very partisan. How much, and you mentioned they figured, well, declaring the Republic of the Pacific might be a way to sit out the war and then right. See who wins. But there were a lot of folks who wanted to fight.
Right, and the election of 1861 is where that got settled at the polls. Starr King is going around giving lectures throughout that whole summer, and the Republican Party is organizing. And the gubernatorial election of 1861 puts Leland Stanford into the governorship of California with a 46% plurality. And so at that point, the unionists begin to breathe a little bit easy. But they're still worried as heck because you still have the southern part of the state, which is adamantly secessionist, to the point where the merchants of San Francisco are writing letters to Washington saying, please leave the regular troops out on the West Coast until we can... you know, find out whether we're going to have a civil war here. And the War Department did. But in July, the War Department authorized Governor Downey to start raising troops in California. And there was a very high rate of enlistment in the northern part of the state. So you actually have, they're called the California Volunteers. And there, I think there was five regiments total. I think four infantry, one cavalry was the initial troop raising, and they are being trained to secure California, and when it became clear that California was basically manageable, then the War Department started pulling out the U.S. regular army from the entirety of the West, and that's where the big switcheroo happened, because all these young men, very patriotic young men, decided they were going to enlist, and they thought they were going to be, you know, shipped off to fight rebels, be it in Southern California or Virginia or wherever they were. And instead, most of them find themselves assigned to the duties of the old regular army. So that finds them flung across the western United States over the next few years, engaging in some really serious Indian fighting, which is not very well known because the big storyline of that time is the carnage going on back east. The battles in the west were smaller scale, but if you were parties to them, they were big enough to keep you on your toes.
And you say western United States, though a lot of these what are now states were territories back then.
That's correct. Yes. The biggest one, the biggest campaign was the campaign of the California Column. They were troops that were originally raised and trained in Southern California to keep a lid on the secesh down there. And then in 1862, there was a Confederate invasion of the Southwest, launched from Texas. And they were basically headed for California. They wanted to liberate, in their terms, New Mexico and Arizona, the territories. And they were supposed to, on their way, stop off in Colorado and take the gold fields there and then come out to California and seize the gold fields here. And if they had any spare time, they were supposed to rip off a couple of provinces of Mexico. War planning was not terribly realistic at the start of the war. So the fellow who's in charge of that invasion, well, his troops referred to him as the walking whiskey barrel, which is never a good sign if you're launching an invasion. He ends up coming out from Texas with an army that is initially quite successful. They do take New Mexico. They take Albuquerque and Santa Fe. And, in fact, some of their troops end up in Tucson. So you have a Confederate government in Tucson. And, in fact, the settlers of Tucson had voted to join the Confederacy. So they're not that far from California. In the meanwhile, the California volunteers who've been trained in Southern California are massing at Fort Yuma, which is on the border of Arizona. And they are preparing to head east and deal with this Confederate column that is intending to come west. So the expected collision is somewhere between Yuma and New Mexico. Now, as it turns out, the Colorado miners, nobody told them that they were supposed to be conquered by the Confederates. Instead, they poured out in large numbers. They came down into New Mexico, and they thrashed the Confederates at, there's a battle called Glorieta Pass. And, in fact, that was a stalemate tactically, but the Confederate supply train was destroyed, which meant that the invasion was doomed to failure. Campaigning the Southwest would be, in 1860, would be like campaigning on the moon today. Basically, the problem, you were worried about fighting your enemy, but the main problem was getting to the battlefield and supplying yourself. And so when the Confederates lost their supply train, they were in desperate shape. In fact, about a third of his army disappeared, either killed or captured, as they reeled back into Texas. Meanwhile, the Californians march out, and their war isn't against Confederates. They have a few skirmishes, including the westernmost action of the Civil War, which is in Arizona, where Californians are fighting Confederates. But the reality is that they are left with something that makes the Confederates look like pretty easy work. They have to deal with the Comanche, the Kiowa, the Apaches, and the Navajo. And they are dealing with a region that has known just pandemic war. It's just nonstop war between the various tribes, among whom are the New Mexicans of Spanish descent, and various Indian tribes who have little use for each other. There's no sort of pan-Indian solidarity there. They've been raiding each other for generations. And into this maelstrom steps the California Column. All these fellows who thought they were going to be fighting Confederates instead find themselves out in the middle of Llano Estacado, dealing with a whole bunch of really irate Comanches. So it was a surprising war in a lot of ways for them.
Now, California is all this time producing gold, and that gold is extraordinarily important to the Union cause.
Yes.
How do the Confederates react to all this gold being shipped?
Well, that was one of the ideas behind Sibley's invasion, the walking whiskey barrels. He was supposed to get out here and start a war in California that would tie up the gold fields. Because as the war grinds on, both administrations are driven to despair by the financial aspect. While Southern women are melting down their jewelry, the North has access to the richest gold deposits then producing on the planet. which are here. And so there are a lot of southern schemes to try to deal with that situation. My favorite is a plan to launch a privateer from San Francisco. A group of southern partisans got together, and they were well-heeled, some of them, and they bought a schooner, which is the favorite rig for a privateer at that point. It's rigged fore and aft, it's fast, it's maneuverable, and it carries enough metal so that you can approach a Pacific steamship, say, with a million or a million and a half in gold, and sink it if you have to. So they are busy manning this thing, drawing sailors from the local castle of the Knights of the Golden Circle, which is the pro-Confederate secret society. And they are buying cannons down in Mexico and bringing them up in crates labeled machinery. And they have stowed the hold of this privateer, and they are all set to go out and capture California gold. But their navigator has ratted them out. And so they're all sitting around the evening before the launch, waiting for the navigator who's going to get them out the Golden Gate, who has had second thoughts and is busy talking to the San Francisco police. And so the great Confederate naval operation of the Pacific Coast ends the next morning when the U.S. Sloop of War, Cyan, sends over boatloads of sailors and Marines, and the San Francisco Police Department has a steam launch, you know, chugging up to them, and that's, you know, they all end up in Alcatraz. The Confederate conspirators end up doing some time in Alcatraz.
And yet, there were other ways that the Confederacy could attack the gold shipments.
There were, and some of them had good success. So nearby San Francisco, there was some real secesh partisans in action. This was in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And they had an active castle of the Knights of the Golden Circle, and they were all training to be active partisans in California. They came to the attention of a Confederate officer who had served in Missouri, which was a training ground for the most extreme kinds of partisan warfare. It was really a hellish scene in Missouri. This Confederate officer had basically found it advisable for him to get out of Missouri. He had participated in a particularly savage raid on a town that was burned and all the men in it were killed, the Lawrence, Kansas raid. So this officer is named Ingram, Henry Rufus Ingram, and he hears about these partisans. He's told about them by a Californian who has come east. And Ingram decides, hey, tell you what, I'll go west and I'll start fighting out in California. I hear there's a bunch of partisans who need a practiced leader. And so he does. He comes all the way out from Texas, and he ends up in the Santa Cruz Mountains training these guys. And their job is to go raid San Jose. They want to do to San Jose what Ingram had done to Lawrence, Kansas. And the idea was to earn a lot of money and then take the whole unit back east and fight for Jefferson Davis. The San Jose gambit doesn't pan out because these guys, they're very enthusiastic, but they talk a lot, and word gets out. And so they find that they need another plan. And the other plan was to hit stagecoaches. And so, in fact, Ingram and I think it was about six of these partisans ride out to Placerville, and they nail one of the stagecoaches that's coming down from the Comstock load. So it's got silver and gold.
Comstock load, this is over in Nevada.
Over in Nevada. And the stage route for the bullion takes you over the Sierra and down into Placerville. And so these fellows, you know, they intercept the stage, and they're busy unloading the loot from this stage when another stage rolls up behind them, and the second stage sees the first stage stops and assumes that they're having mechanical difficulty. So the driver of the second stage stops, and he says, "Can I be of assistance?" And Ingram says, "You certainly can." So they have the loot from two stages. And what is particularly entertaining about this story is that that Ingram leaves a receipt from the Confederate States of America. And he leaves the amount blank because he doesn't know how much loot he's got. But he wants everybody to know that this money has not been taken, you know, to so that they can all run over to the next brothel and bar and have a good time. This money is being used for the Confederate States of America. And it was, in fact, this incident, T.J. Meekins, that I worked with on our novel Queen of the Northern Mines, it was this incident that gave us the idea for a Confederate partisan campaign in California based upon seizing gold. And this idea of the receipt being left behind is actually employed in the book.
Who was John Mosby? What did he do?
He was probably the United States' most dangerous partisan commander ever. He was a Virginia lawyer. This will show you how dangerous some lawyers can be. He was a pro-Union Virginian before the war. He looked for opportunities to try to talk people out of secession. But when that great crisis came, a lot of people in Virginia, despite their feelings, opted to go out with Virginia. Like Robert Lee did the same thing, pretty much. He was in the same position. He did not want to secede, but when secession came, he chose Virginia. Mosby did the same. He enlisted as a private, but he had a natural gift for war that soon made itself felt. So by 1863, Lee and Jeb Stuart have looked at Mosby's work and say, this is our guy. And they put him in charge of a battalion of what they call partisan rangers. And this is behind the lines work. Mosby is riding behind the federal lines in Northern Virginia. And his men are farmers by day and they're guerrillas by night. And he ties the entire Union supply system in Northern Virginia in knots. He's busy derailing locomotives, capturing supply trains. It's the most successful asymmetric warfare that I've ever heard of. He's literally got 10,000 Union soldiers out of the battle trying to chase him and his 200 raiders. And he comes into our story. He's in the book because of the Californians who went back east to fight. I've described how many Californians signed up in good faith and they wanted to fight rebels and were shunted instead to Indian campaigns. Well, there was a group of men in San Francisco who wanted to volunteer. They felt the country was in danger and they did not want to have that happen to them. So they very cleverly arranged to appeal to the governor of Massachusetts.
Excuse me, I'm going to jump in.
Sure.
They did not want that to happen to them. They did not want to become Indian fighters.
Right, right. They wanted to be sure that if they were volunteering, that they were going to be fighting rebels. And so what they did is they sent a letter to John Andrew, who was governor of Massachusetts, saying, if you will ship us east, we will fight in a Massachusetts regiment. And Andrew took them up on it. So they did. They sailed via Panama to Boston, initially in a group of 100, a single company, and then finally more men were added until it became a full battalion in terms of numbers, although they never fought together as a battalion. But they did all fight in the 2nd Massachusetts Regiment. And that's where Mosby comes into the story, because the 2nd Massachusetts had the unenviable task of trying to keep a lid on Mosby. It's not the assignment you'd want to draw. The 2nd Massachusetts was led by a young Boston Brahmin by the name of Lowell. It's a very famous name in New England. He was a young man with tuberculosis. He was a valedictorian of his class at Harvard. And yet when the war came, he volunteered. And despite his physical frailty, rose to command a regiment of cavalry. And he was in charge of the 2nd Massachusetts, and that is the regiment that the Californians ended up providing about half the men for that regiment. And so the best stories of Californians fighting in the Civil War against Confederates, the most astonishing stories, come from that campaign. And I've got a few of them in the book. But it was desperate business because the Californians were riding in staunchly secessionist territory. So Mosby knew where they were, where they were going, and how many of them there were. and he was wildly inventive and fearless in battle. So he was not the guy you'd want to, you know, necessarily dance with in Northern Virginia.
Mosby survived the war.
He did. His tactics were unusual, and a lot of Union officers thought he should be hanged after the war because they thought he had violated the rules of war. In fact, Mosby had stayed very much on the edge of them, and he convinced Grant. Mosby's wife actually went to plead to Grant to intercede for her husband because she was worried he was going to be hanged. And the two met and became fast friends. So Mosby then backed Grant in the 1868 presidential election, which was not the social thing to do in Northern Virginia after the war. So the death threats came in to Mosby hot and heavy, and Grant decided that after he became president, Grant decided that it would be a good idea if Mosby went to China for a while. And so he made him an envoy to got him away from the South, because the feelings after the war were terribly bitter, and Mosby was a great Southern hero. But like Longstreet, any Southern hero who then showed weakness, joining the Republican Party or supporting a Republican candidate, found himself ostracized at best and dead at worst.
Californians who had gone east to fight rebels did have a part in the last battles of the war.
They did indeed. There were that 2nd Massachusetts Regiment became the shock troops of Lowell as he rose through the Union command structure. And Lowell ended up being Sheridan's chief cavalry officer in the Shenandoah campaign of late 1864. And so it was the California troops who would lead a charge or defend a retreat. And if you're working for Sheridan, that's a high-risk assignment. And so over the course of the war, of the 502 men who volunteered from California, 182 were left standing at the end. Some had been promoted away, some had retired sick, but you know, mostly they had been killed off, or worse, sent to Andersonville. If you were in that theater and you were captured, you would actually go to Andersonville. And so a lot of Californians ended up experiencing that horror. For those who weren't aware of it, that was the worst prisoner of war camp in a war that had terrible prisoner of war camps. So the Californians were working with Sheridan in the final stages of the war, and it was Sheridan's men who actually fought the pivotal battle that got Union cavalry out past Lee as he retreated. Lee had to abandon Richmond, and Sheridan's
Richmond's the capital.
Capital of the Confederacy. And it was the last stronghold. And everybody saw that when Richmond was abandoned, that the Southern cause was in desperate shape. And Lee attempted to flee westward to try to escape Grant's army. And then he was going to go south and try to join General Johnston in North Carolina. And it was Sheridan's cavalry who basically swung around Lee and faced him and headed him off. And so it was a thin line of cavalry that stopped the Confederate flight, and the Californian, you know, 2nd Massachusetts was in that line. And it was the appearance of Union infantry behind that line that finally convinced Lee that the game was over.
Filling in after...
Yeah, basically he was not going to dislodge infantrymen. He thought he could brush aside the cavalry, but that finally, as the Union troops really filled in, and Lee was in complete disarray. I mean, in fact, his effort to join Johnston was an act of despair. I mean, you could easily call it a fantasy.
The war ended. How did California react? How did things come together in California after the war?
The first word that came to mind was poorly. There was a strong Union party in California that was composed of Northern Democrats and Republicans, and they held firm throughout the course of the war. Many Democrats, both in California and in the East, became disenchanted with the war. They were sick of the casualties of the whole effort, the blood, the cost. And so there was an anti-war Democratic movement that was very strong. and they put up a candidate in the 1864 presidential election. They also put up John Downey in California, who, while he had opted for the Union in 1861, Downey had looked at Republican California, and he saw signs of racial equality that he didn't care for. He was, like many Democrats, tired of the war, so he ran for governor and was defeated in 1864. So the Union coalition held over the course of the war, but then once the war is over, the pressure is off, and the Democratic Party reunites. They shed their alliance. The Northern Democrats shed the alliance with the Republicans. The Democratic Party reunites, and it becomes dominant in California again, just as it had been in the 1850s. Now, it's true that there had been some significant changes as a result of the war. Black slavery was definitively outlawed. Indian slavery was also repealed in Sacramento, as you know, basically it was just too embarrassing to say, yeah, okay, we can have a little bit of slavery out here, but that was voted down in 1863. So there was an institutional shift in California, but the underlying attitudes hadn't changed at all. So the next racial fault line wasn't between the Indians or the blacks and the whites of California, but between the Chinese and the whites. Chinese immigration had been widespread. There were a lot of Chinese laborers coming in. And so whenever you had an economic recession, you would have competition for jobs, and the Chinese were resented, bitterly resented by whites in California. Oh, and just as a marker of that, when the 14th Amendment was put up for ratification among the states, and that's the one that guarantees you equal protection under the law based on race, or any condition really, equal protection of law. The old southern states all, you know, robustly voted that down. They didn't want to have anything to do with that. And yet they were forced to adopt it as a term of re-entering the Union. One state didn't want to have anything to do with that, and never had to recant because they were never part of the Confederacy, and that was California. California not only did not ratify the 14th Amendment, they ignored it completely. It wasn't passed until 1958. All right. So if you look at California's past in terms of racial equity, you have to take a deep breath, because it was not a bastion of progressive thinking.
I'm speaking with Richard Hurley, the author of California and the Civil War. Richard, if folks want to find this book, they want to pick up this book in a real brick-and-mortar store, where would they find it?
Kit Holden's bookseller in Grass Valley has it right by the front door, bless her. I stopped by SPD1. I'm not sure David Payne, I wasn't able to see David Payne yet, but he may carry it. But right now, for sure, Kit's got it. And if you are looking online, The History Press is the publisher.
What? I know you've just finished this. You might be taking a breath and kicking back a little bit, but yeah. Do you see another project on the horizon?
I do. You know, TJ and I have done a lot of multimedia work. And we have a show. In fact, it was our California Civil War show that we developed to support the novel, to promote the novel Queen of the Northern Mines, that led to this book. And we have a couple of other shows we've done, one on American California and the Fate of the Nation on.
These are multimedia shows.
Multimedia shows that we do at historical societies and museums, and, you know, basically anybody, you know, gathers an audience that is interested in history. And I'd like to put as much of that multimedia up on the web as possible. So I am working on a nonprofit called California Educational Multimedia, and the website is caleducationalmedia.org. And I am still doing the multimedia shows. I'm still working on developing them, but I'd like to get as much of the content up on the web as possible, because I think that's the right way to reach people with history.
And you've got an awful lot of content here. That's,
there's a lot of history.
Yeah.
And the wonderful thing about history is it's reinterpreted by every generation. So the events that are described once are seen in a new light by people in later times.
Which brings up my last question I did want to ask you, and that is, whenever I'm reading history, I'm sure anyone does this, first we have to remind ourselves that there's all this stuff happening. There was technology of the time, so they didn't realize that computers were going to come in, phones. There were the various forces of other nations around them, of all sorts of things, demographics of the people who used to live here. All of these things are happening. So it's not like, well, some politician just shot another politician, and we see it happening again. Oh, is this a repeat? Well, there's a lot of different forces happening. You can't say it's the same thing. At the same time, people are people.
That's a persistent problem.
So how much can you look at what was going on in California during the Civil War and maybe look at what's going on now and say, well, this has some lessons for us?
It does. Partisanship is a persistent problem in American politics. The Civil War is the most acute case, obviously, and our inability to settle our political issues cost about 700,000 American lives at that point.
Civil War.
Yeah, there's a big toll for the government, basically failing to deal with a critical issue. The issue being, how do we disengage from an economic system that everybody saw, or many people saw, as cruel? You know, there was a shift in attitude in Western civilization about slavery, and England succeeded in doing it. France succeeded in doing it. We didn't. Okay? And what happens in partisanship is that people start assuming that the person on the other side is the devil, and they start believing nonsense. It's an old American tradition, too. I should say that the first real contested American election was Adams versus Jefferson in 1800, and the hysterical ravings in the press are, you know, oddly reminiscent of today. I like to think that Adams and Jefferson were stronger candidates, maybe, than we've seen of late. But the impulse to divide and the impulse to slander and just go off, I think, to be honest, Alan, it's primate behavior. I think, you know, if we want to have a show on biology, you know, we can try that one out. There is a natural tendency to separate into different camps and protect your turf. And it's something that we really do have to keep an eye on. Abraham Lincoln was very cognizant of the value of the Constitution as a way of keeping the human person who is prone to bad behavior, murderous behavior, in check. And I think we should listen to him.
Richard, thank you very much for coming in. It's been delightful this hour and last week's hour. Both, the first one's already podcast. This one will be up as a podcast real soon.
Great. Thanks for having me, Alan.
My pleasure. I've been speaking with Richard Hurley, the author of California and the Civil War. It is published by The History Press. I'm Al Stoller.